Hearing Umi's defiant, decisive shout, both Hikari and Nanami stopped fighting and turned to look, in time to see the ice dragon plow into Toga and send him sprawling back across the platform. "Toga!" Nanami screamed, and then Umi crossed the gap to her enemy and ended him, and Nanami howled again, louder, "Toga!" Breaking away from Hikaru with a vicious kick, she started running across the platform at top speed, her scimitar raised. Umi, still kneeling by the crenellated edge of the platform, head bowed, didn't seem to hear her coming.
"Umi!"
Hikaru cried, running after the grief-crazed blonde.
"Look out!"
She cursed. The cuts to her legs were hampering her running speed. She'd never catch Nanami in time.
"Nanami, stop! Stop! Don't make me!"
Nanami couldn't hear her. The roaring of blood in her ears drowned out everything but her own shriek of rage as she charged toward the blue-haired creature who had robbed her forever of the one prize she valued. Nall heard her coming before Umi, and, turning his head, saw the blonde bearing down on them, her blade raised high.
"Oslag," he whispered. Umi, come on, get up."
Umi shook her head. Whether she was trying to clear it or refusing his request, Nall didn't know, nor care. The mushiness of the gesture told him that she was still barely conscious. So did the fact that she hadn't noticed he'd pronounced her name correctly. Not knowing what else he could do, he seized the lower edge of her long, pointed ear in his fangs and tugged with all his remaining strength, tasting blood. The pain brought her back to herself. Yowling in outrage, she turned toward it, opening her mouth to remonstrate with the wicked little creature who had hurt her, and saw Nanami coming like an artillery shell, screaming and implacable. Umi tried to get her blade into position, but there was no time. The blonde was nearly on top of her, the scimitar blow already starting to fall. There was a hard, solid thud, as of a heavy book falling from a table, and Nanami's slender body jerked, her stride faltering as her wrathful face went suddenly blank. Her cloudy gray eyes went wide, then suddenly cleared, as if she had just awakened from a long dream. The scimitar fell from her hand, clattering onto the dueling stage next to Umi. The blonde took three more stumbling strides past the puzzled rune knight, then fell to her knees near the edge of the platform.
"Oh," said Nanami softly. "God."
Then she sprawled on her face in one of the crenellations, one arm hanging down over the side of the platform. Jutting from her back was the jeweled hilt of her own jambia. Umi gasped and looked back to where she'd come from. 30 feet away stood Hikaru Shido, left hand still extended, drops of blood dripping from her fingertips. She'd wrenched the weapon from her own shoulder and thrown it with all her waning might, so desperate was she to save her friend. Now, her face clouded with horror and disbelief, she walked slowly to Umi's side and stood over Nanami's body, staring down at it.
I killed her,"
Hikaru whispered as Umi got to her feet.
"You sure did," Nall said. "Would it help if I pointed out that she was just about to split my cute little skull like an apple when you did it?"
Hikaru turned to look at him. His feline face was somber, ears drooping. He cocked his head at Umi's.
"Hers too," he added.
Hikaru gave a brave smile and ruffled his ears.
"Thanks, Nall," she said. "It does help a little."
Fu Ho-Oji and her opponent missed every bit of all that, so wrapped up were they in their own interpretations of their battle. The more she watched the raspberry-haired girl fight, the more she felt her enemy's assault against her defenses, the more convinced was Fu that this was not a wholly willing participant in this tragic play. Shiori fought like a puppet, jerkily, with speed and strength, but little coordination. It looked like she might actually be a good fencer, but the way she was going about it now, it wouldn't have been hard for Fu to outthink her attack and finish her.
But look at her eyes, thought Fu to herself. The mind behind those eyes isn't even here right now. The same thing has happened to her that happened to that poor man Lafarga. This girl isn't evil, she's sick. She needs a chance at redemption, not oblivion.
She smiled. I'm sorry for this, Miss Shiori, she said, caught the girl's blade on her own, half turned inside her reach, and struck her squarely in the face with an elbow. Shiori staggered back, raising a hand to her bloodied nose, and Fu drove the heart of the storm into the platform to free both her hands. Eternal wind, breath of life, bearer of the storm, cleanser of the lands and waters, heed your master and come forth to wrap this lost soul in your firm and healing embrace. Whirling her hands around her in a great circular gesture, she finished with both hands extended as though in welcome to her opponent and cried, Wind of absolution! Shiori jerked bolt upright as a wave of green mist swirled around her, raising her clean off the platform. Her sword clanged to the stone from nerveless fingers as she stretched upward, rigid from head to toe, in the column of wind, her hair whipping all around her face. After a moment it subsided, and she fell slowly back down. When her toes touched the platform, she crumbled into a sloppy César, hands splayed before her, head bowed to the stone. After a moment she raised her face to Fu's, tears rolling down both of her cheeks from eyes haunted, but no longer racked with madness.
Thank you,
she whispered, and collapsed into unconsciousness. Corwin's lunge caught Akio Itori with one foot on the upper platform and one still on the top step. Unbalanced, the slender man stumbled, caught himself, and rolled, his scarlet-lined white cape flying around him as he came to his feet with sword drawn. You again? Akio asked. You're as persistent as Tenjo, boy, I'll grant you that. Corwin didn't waste time or energy talking. He merely whirled stick around his body and went on the offensive. Very soon, he began to realize that he might be in over his head. Akio was a remarkably agile combatant and strong for his build, perhaps even stronger than Corwin, who wasn't yet fully grown. Plus, he didn't fight fair. Every time Corwin blocked one of Akio's cuts or thrusts with stick, the dark man tried to slide the blade along the wood and cut at Corwin's hands. A couple of times he succeeded, but not seriously. Corwin was also a bit distracted by the fact that this upper platform confirmed his awful, sinking suspicion. This platform was oval, not circular, about the same width on its long axis as the radius of the dueling floor. At the far end, opposite the stairs, was a one-step-raised circular dais. Corwin didn't have to see that dais to know that its edge was paved in a magic circle. This was the place where the Pillar of Sephiro, the spirit responsible for the shape and survival of the Tenth World, was created. And it wouldn't have taken a sorcerer to figure out what Akio was planning to do with it, even if Corwin hadn't been one. He couldn't let that happen. He just couldn't. It would destroy the already tortured balance of Sephiro and plunge the Tenth World into complete disarray. It would hand Akio Itori power over the very substance of a reality on the doorstep of Asgard itself. It would trap Anthihimemia in an eternity of pain. And if that happened, then a person very close to Corwin's heart would suffer for all eternity right along with her. He couldn't let that happen. He just couldn't. But what could he do? Sephiro had to have a pillar. Without one, it would collapse into chaos and disappear, all the lives upon it lost. Emerald was dead. Someone had to replace her. If not Anthy, then who? What could Corwin do to stop Akio, to save Anthy, without sacrificing Sephiro? He didn't know, but letting Akio win was obviously not the answer, and anyway, his hatred for this man was pounding in his temples like a migraine headache. He decided to concentrate on defeating his enemy first, then figure out how to save the world if he was still alive to attempt it. Gritting his teeth, he flung himself against Akio's guard and earned a shallow gash across his right shoulder for his trouble. Stumbling back, he missed a block and got a nick to his wrist and a minor slash to his left thigh. Akio was toying with him, nickel and diming him to death. Corwin was between the man and his intended victim, but that was all the progress he'd been able to make. Anger surged through his body, renewing his strength, doubling his fury, forcing more effort from his aching, straining, bleeding body. Akio merely smiled and stepped up his counterattack. Corwin cursed inwardly. Who was this guy? Then it hit him. The slender build, the faint but, at this range, easily noticed mark on his forehead, the dark skin, the aquiline nose and delicate features, the knowledge of the workings of Sephiro that no native of the 10th world should have. "You're a Svartelf," Corwin gasped. Akio shook his head and smiled mockingly. "Not entirely," he replied. "Our dear mother was exiled from Svartalfheim for some trivial offense. You have a knowledge of the 9 worlds? You must not be from Midgard." Corwin snarled and thrust one of Styx's ferules at that mocking smile. Akio sidestepped, pushed the staff aside with his free hand, and flicked the point of his blade against one of Corwin's cheek tattoos. "You're marked," Akio observed. "Too rugged to be an elf, too tall to be a dwarf. You're not an Ys, or you'd be more than a match for me. One of the Vanir, perhaps? They never were quite up to the standard." Corwin said nothing. He knew he was losing this fight, but he couldn't give up. He searched his mind for something that might help him turn this around, and found nothing. Akio obliged. "You put up a decent fight, boy," Akio mused. "But it's futile. Only the Rose Knight could ever stand a chance against me." He sneered, flicking his blade against Corwin's other cheek. "And she's cowering in another dimension, unable to act. Her access to this place was sealed off by her own stupidity." Corwin remembered the sealed door standing at the end of the catwalk off the edge of the dueling platform, off to his left as he'd crossed it at a run, remembering the story Utrina had told him about the Rose Gate. What had happened there, the culmination of all Akio's machinations and manipulations. Patronized, stabbed in the back, shattered, callously discarded, never loved, only used. White-hot rage surged across Corwin's nerves, setting his divine brand alight with a keening noise. His eyes narrowed, pupils shrinking. Rage and hatred swirled around him almost visibly as he relived the monolith, the sobbing, the trembling, the feeling of utter and total uselessness. "My curse upon you, Akio Tori," he snarled in his mother tongue. "By my will and by my power, birthright from my divine mother, this is my command. May you never know completion, may you never know achievement, may you never know success, but always frustration, always shortfall, always failure." Akio sneered mockingly and lunged. Corwin slipped the strike, whirled Styx about him, and thrust it billiard cue style through his curled left hand. As the ferrule on the forward end passed through his hand, it began to glow with the same scarlet light as his raging brand. "I am Corwin of the Raven Hair," he roared, and as the ferrule smacked firmly into the vestigial dot of a brand in the center of Akio's forehead, he completed the curse. "Let the covenant of my hatred be sealed upon your brow." There was an actinic flash of light at the point of contact, and the electric thrill rushed up Corwin's arms and snapped back his head as Akio reeled, crashing to the stones on his back with smoke curling up from his forehead. Behind them, Anthihimemia felt her ears begin to pound and realized that she'd been holding her breath since the black-haired stranger with the amazing blue eyes first attacked the thing that had once been her brother. She let it out, drew it in again. As if triggered by that action, Akio sprang to his feet, his face twisted in mocking hatred. "You think you can curse me, child of Vanaheim?" he inquired in incredulous disbelief. "Me? Goodbye, interloper. Give the Rose Knight my regards when you see her in hell." He made a negligent gesture, and a rippling, near-invisible something lashed across the space between them and smashed into Corwin like a speeding bus. Screaming, every muscle and nerve on fire, the fledgling god was catapulted backward across the magic circle and over the edge of the platform into yawning space. Down, down, down he fell, trailing blue-white sparks, until he crashed down dead center on the battle-scarred dueling floor. A wave of energy rolled outward from his body as he hit, overwhelming the other knights as well, and laying all of them low with shrieks of pain. "Damn," Corwin thought as his body convulsed and his senses reeled. "I should have known he'd have Zagato's power. He killed the High Priest to drive the Pillar to despair, but in doing so, he'd have to have absorbed some of his power. And now he's sealed the lot of us. Damn, 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 damn! How could I have been so stupid?" Corwin struggled to rise, his body still racked with pain, and accomplished very little. Above, a brilliant yellow light was rising from the circle. Below, the bells of Otori Academy clamored. The sky above them darkened. At first it seemed like nightfall. Then he heard what sounded like a million metallic bat's wings, and knew it for what it was. The cursed flying swords, thousands of them, legend said a million, taking up their positions in the sky above the pillar circle. There, the embodiment of Sephiroth's wrath, they waited to rend anyone who tried to gain access to the circle platform and interrupt the creation of a new pillar. Damn. He gritted his teeth, clenched his fists around stick, and heaved himself to elbows and knees. Then his strength failed him, and with an angry, agonized gasp, he fell back to his face, the blue-white sealing energy still sizzling around him.
"It can't end this way," he snarled, squeezing his eyes shut on hot tears of pain and frustration. "It can't! Damn it! Damn it!"
He drove his fist into the stone, pushed with all the strength he could muster, levered himself up. Blood trickled from the corner of his mouth where he'd bitten his lip, falling, from his nose where it had slammed against the platform, from the cuts on his cheeks, and an abrasion over his left eyebrow. He got his hands under him, looked blurrily down at the gleaming ring on his hand. A drop of pink liquid, Corwin's mingled blood, sweat, and tears, ran down his face, poised on the tip of his nose, hesitated, and fell, splashing squarely on the center of the rose signet. Fitfully, the mark on his brow glowed again. On his wedding finger, so did the rose ring. The pain did not abate. If anything, it grew worse. but some strength returned to his limbs anyway. Gritting his teeth to the point where he felt they might crack, Corwin forced himself to his feet, then turned to face the Rose Gate. He took a shuffling step forward, then another, and another. As he went, his pace picked up, from a pained shuffle to a limp to a walk, and within a dozen paces he was pelting forward in an all-out run, arms pumping, legs flying, all pain pushed aside. As he ran, the words to one of the most powerful spells his mother had taught him during his training as a weaponsmith, one of the greatest of the ancient magics, came unbidden to his mind, and without even stopping to consider the possible consequences, he began to speak them. Sword of cold and darkness, be ye loosed from heaven's bonds. Power that can smash even the souls of the gods, become one with my power, one with my body, and let us walk the path of destruction together. Black lightning crackled across his brand, down his arms, played over the length of stick. Pain coursed through Corwin's veins with every beat of his pounding heart, as his will, the spell's incredible power, and his mother's blood fought against the seal Akio had placed on him and worked the sorcery anyway. At the peak of his running speed, Corwin hurled himself forward, thrusting the energy-shrouded staffs feral at the heart of the sealed gate, and screamed the key phrase at the top of his lungs,
Ragna Blade!
The black energy bit into the stone seal of the Rose Gate. There was a tremendous explosion, a black-edged silver shockwave lashing out in all directions from the gate. Corwin tumbled end over end, somehow keeping his grip on stick, and wound up in a sloppy, loose-limbed, stunned approximation of César, dead center in the middle of the platform. Above, the lights of the castle carved from the roots of the world tree pulsed, shifting in their colors with a kind of tense expectancy. Corwin raised his head, then let it fall back, turning his face to the castle's light, eyes closed. White light poured out of the shattered seal of the Rose Gate, fixing him in its glare as if he were caught in the headlights of an oncoming car. A moment later, a figure stepped through the gate, out of the light, crossed the catwalk, and knelt at Corwin's side, putting a hand on his shoulder and speaking his name. Feeling the touch, hearing the voice, he gasped, his eyes flying wide, and the glow of his mark spiked with a high-pitched sound. He turned his head. Utena Tenjo was kneeling next to him, dressed in the black and crimson of her old Otori Academy dueling uniform. In her top pocket, a white rose ruffled slightly in the wind blowing across the platform. At her side, she wore the blade Corwin had made for her. She was looking at him with a mixture of concern and utter bafflement. Corwin grinned, feeling his strength flood back as she clasped his hand in hers and helped him to his feet. He wondered if the phenomenon were an actual countercharm or just a measure of how glad he was to see her. Around him, the sprawled magic knights also stirred and got to their feet.
Corwin, what's going on? Asked Uchna. A minute ago I was in bed, and now I'm...
She looked around and gasped.
Back in Sephiro? But that's impossible.
Corwin shook his head. You're not back in Sephiro. Not quite.
This is the dueling floor. I thought it was destroyed, and it was never real to begin with.
Oh, it was real. What you saw at the end was the illusion. The dueling floor isn't really in Sephiro and can never be destroyed. Look, I can't explain right now. He turned to the knights. Hikaru Shido, Knight of the Flame. Umi Ryozaki, Knight of the Sea. I believe you've met Fuho Oji, Knight of the Storm. And of course you already know Nall, he added with a grin to the little creature perched on Umi's shoulder. Meet Utna Tenjo, Knight of the Rose. Utna, Hikari, Umi, Fu, Nal. Then he squared himself, gripped stick tightly, and said, "Cover me." Hearing the urgency in his voice, his four fellow rune knights didn't hesitate. They merely readied themselves and nodded to him. Anthy looked up at the swords and felt no fear, only a kind of quiet sadness. Akio was almost finished with his preparations on the circle. The stranger had failed and fallen. There had been a terrible noise from below shortly after he fell, but since then, nothing. "I'm sorry, Utna," she thought. "I waited as long as I could. I can't let Akio succeed. You must understand. If he puts me in that circle, everything will be over anyway. Better Sephiroth be destroyed than his plan succeed." She took a step toward the platform's edge, wondering if she could reach it before Akio noticed. Perhaps he would try to stop her, and she could take them both over. That would be a good death. Good enough. On the landing of the stairs to the circle platform, as the million swords took notice of him, Corwin lunged forward, raising stick in his hands. At the landing's edge, he slammed one of the staff's ferrules into a gap between paving stones, sending up a fire spout of orange sparks, and vaulted into the air. All around him, the knights leaped as well, their blades ready, and the air was filled with the sound of clashing metal as they deflected the army of flying swords that arrowed toward their friend and themselves. Nal launched himself from Umi's shoulder as the Knight of the Sea reached the apogee of her leap, and with a sky-shattering roar he reassumed his true form, great wings spreading wide, vast serpentine body blotting the platform into shadow. The swords tangled in his fur and clattered from his armored hide. Some cut, but only angered him. Banking sharply, he swept into the vanguard of the five heroes, his icy breath lashing huge numbers of the flying blades from the sky. Once he wasn't using it to propel his vault anymore, Corwin switched stick ahead of him, whirling it again as if it were a propeller. It didn't give him any motive power, but it did shield him fairly effectively from the blades that got past Nal, letting the others use their energies to defend themselves. Some got through his guard. He felt a dozen or so stinging pains here and there as the edges tore at clothes and slashed him. Still, when he landed on the upper platform, with the knights dropping into formation around him, he was not much more harmed than when he'd leaped. Still riding the surge of energy Utrin's arrival had provided him, Corwin wasted no time congratulating himself on having accomplished the impossible task of getting up here, and instead braced himself for another impossible task. Nal, now utterly exhausted from driving himself at full power again without sufficient rest, returned to his small form and alighted on Umi's shoulder again, slumping half-conscious against her neck and cheek. Absently, she scratched at his ears. They weren't too late. Anthy wasn't inside the circle yet. Akio was still preparing it for her entry. There was still time. "Otori!" Corwin barked. Akio Otori turned, puzzled, and for a moment his face went absolutely blank with astonishment. He quickly recovered himself, though, and turned with a placid smile to face them. "Back for more?" he inquired pleasantly. "I must admit I'm rather impressed. I didn't think you'd even be able to get up after I sealed what was left of your power." "I had help," said Corwin, and he stepped aside. Akio's face blanked again, just for an instant, as Utna stepped forward, past Corwin, to face him. "So," he murmured, "here you are again." Seeing Utna, Anthy gave a sharp little sound and abruptly shoved her way past Akio, running across the platform to meet her. Silently, the two women fell into an embrace. For just an instant, they were frozen that way, the image imprinted forever in Corwin's brain. Utina's hands folded at the small of Anthe's back, Anthe's hands framing Utina's face, their lips almost but not quite touching. The look on Utina's face was the most beautiful thing Corwin had ever seen. Her eyes closed, perfectly still, perfectly composed, a look of utter and total serenity. There was a rightness about the whole image that shook him to the core of his being. Something inside him bent, cracked, and broke in two, and in that one eternal instant, Corwin Ravenhair fully understood the shape of everything. He knew the only answer to the question he had asked himself a few minutes before. He knew the only way to defeat Akio Otori and preserve the perfect beauty of what he saw before him. And he knew what it would cost him. He knew all of it in the space of that one frozen moment, and for the rest of his days he would be able to call up the image that had sparked it in his mind, perfect in every detail, and savor it. But Akio was moving, and Corwin wrenched himself away from the ecstatic agony of his epiphany and lunged, shouting a warning. He was too late. Before his eyes, Akio destroyed the tableau, wrenching Anthe back by the shoulder as his free hand delivered to Utina another of those bone-jarring jolts of power. She tumbled one way, her sword the other, as Akio roughly slung his sister behind him straight into the pillar circle. The thorn of the rose tumbled over the edge of the platform and vanished from sight. Fortunately, Utina herself didn't fly quite so far. Light surged up from the ruined circle set into the paving stones of the platform, trapping Anthe within a column of light, and Akio's laughter mingled with Utina's scream of rage. Anthe closed her eyes in utter self-disgust, filled with a huge and hollow feeling of total failure. After all her quiet defiance, after her determination to destroy herself before she let Akio succeed, after her promise not to be the helpless victim awaiting Utina's return, what had she done? Distracted by Utina's return, she'd turned her back on Akio, and now she and Utina and her world would pay the ultimate price for her stupidity. "I'm sorry, Utina," she thought once more, bitter tears coursing down her cheeks. "Once again, I've failed you." Outside the circle, Corwin was running again, ignoring the screaming protests of his much-abused body. "You're too late, boy," said Akio as he noticed the wrathful young man bearing down on him. "The process is underway. Nothing can stop it now." Corwin didn't slacken his pace. As he drew even with the sneering high priest, he drew back his left fist and backhanded Akio with all his strength, then ran past as the man reeled, bleeding from where the demigod's rose seal had cut his face. If anything, Corwin increased speed, pounding out every last ounce of speed he could summon from his battered body. Another great yell welled up from somewhere inside him, and he howled in wordless defiance as he lunged forward and slammed himself into the barrier of light that surrounded Anthe. The circle pulsed, and yellow-white lightning clawed at Corwin as he smashed into the foot-thick wall of light and plunged through it up to his waist. Shoulders hunched, he drove stick into another paving gap and, screaming in pain and rage, levered himself forward. There was a great sizzling crack, and he fell through, clothes and hair smoking, to sprawl on the stones at Anthe's feet. Slowly, painfully, he braced himself with stick and forced himself once more to his feet. Anthe's closed eyes had opened at the sound of him crashing into the barrier, and now they widened in shock at the look of intensity on his haggard, bloody face. His eyes burned at her as he dropped stick and seized her by the shoulders. "Hello, Miss Eumemia," he said hurriedly. "We haven't been introduced. My name is Corwin Ravenhair. I'm sorry. he went on without a pause. This will hurt. Silently, Anthy nodded, her eyes telling him in an instant what it would have taken her lips too long to say. Without hesitation, he turned and slammed her into the barrier. It coruscated, emitting an elemental snarl that sounded like a protest. Utina struggled to her feet and took a step toward the circle. Akio, still a little stunned from the unexpected wallop Corwin had given him, tried to interpose himself, but Fu hit him high and Umi hit him low, and as he stumbled back amid the storm of wind and water, Hikaru blazed across the platform with a ringing Seleucian curse and nearly took his head off before he got his blade back into position to defend himself. "Lady Utina, go!" Fu declared, as she and Nal joined their sorcery to Umi's to create a furious, howling wall of wind, ice, and water, blocking Akio's escape from Hikaru. "We will handle this. Sir Corwin will need your help." Utina nodded to her and ran to the circle barrier, her face set in a mingled expression of hope and horror. As she approached, a force pressed against her, radiating outward from the light. She snarled and set herself, pushing against it, slogging onward, one step at a time. Corwin braced himself and threw all his weight and might against Anthy, his shoulder in the center of her back. She didn't make a sound, though the experience was obviously agonizing, as she was forced part way through the barrier. As soon as one of her hands was free, she reached for Utina. Corwin looked over Anthea's shoulder, through the distorting effect of the barrier, at Utina. She gasped to see his face. His brand was glowing so brightly, light pouring from it as from a furnace hatch, that it almost obscured his features, except for his eyes, which blazed at her with their own inner light.
"Utina!" he roared. "For love's sake, take her!"
He reached into himself, found more strength somewhere, and gave one last desperate shove. Utina gritted her teeth and took another step. The lightning from the circle barrier was clawing at her now, lashing charred spots in her uniform and carving an angry red mark across one cheek. Without wincing, she put out her hand, straining forward. Her hand caught Anthy's, their fingers linked, and Utina threw herself backward, holding on with all her strength. There was a tremendous crash of thunder, a blinding flash of light, and a concussive wave lashed out from the barrier, blowing everyone on the platform from their feet. Utina crashed to the stones on her back, the wind knocked from her, with Anthy clutched firmly in her arms, clear of the circle of light. In that circle, Corwin had just enough time to look up at the world tree's roots and murmur, "Oh boy," before the circle pulsed again. Yowling in pain, Corwin rebounded from the barrier to the center as though hit by a car, seemed to fetch up against an invisible wall, and then went rigid, arms flung out from his sides, head thrown back. He levitated, toes barely touching the stone, as some invisible force pulled him straight. The light from his forehead mark glowed brighter and brighter, and then, with a sound like a razor being drawn across glass, it burst upward in a great white streak of lightning, stabbing into the sky, linking him to Yggdrasil. One great scream tore its way out of Corwin, and then he collapsed in a kneeling huddle, the light around him winking out. After the roar of the circle and the scream of the light, the silence that descended was deafening. Utina, Anthy, Akio, and the Magic Knights all got slowly, hesitantly to their feet.
"Are you all right?" Utina asked Anthy.
"Fine," she replied, though she didn't look it. "But what's happened to Sir Corwin?"
"No," murmured Akio. "No, he can't have."
Ironically, it was the first time in a long time that Anthy found herself thinking the same thing as Akio, although her disbelief had a completely different root. No one, no matter how stout-hearted and kind, would ever do such a thing to himself for the sake of a stranger. It just wasn't conceivable. But the boy was marked. He had obviously known what the circle was for. He had to know what was about to happen to him when he thrust her out of the light. Why? Why had he done it? Surely not for her. That curious connection she'd felt when their eyes had met, notwithstanding, no one would take unto himself the burden of the pillar for the sake of someone he'd only just met. So, for love's sake, take her. She gasped, understanding, and the tears sprang to her eyes again. Corwin? Said Umi, edging toward the circle. You okay? Said Hikaru, striding unconcernedly toward it. Be careful, Miss Hikaru, said Fu. It might still be dangerous. Corwin's shoulders rose. Slowly, he pulled himself upright, first standing, then raising his head and throwing his shoulders back. All assembled gasped. The mark on his forehead had changed. Rather than a single circle with a dot in the middle, it was now two concentric circles, still center-dotted, with three lines radiating out from that dot to the outer ring. Smoke still rose from it, blowing away in the soft wind that was now coursing across the platform. His thick, jet-black hair was blown into an even wilder tousle than usual, and in the front, the one stout forelock which always stood proudly out from the rest had turned from black to pure, shining silver. He smiled through the grime and blood that still marked his drawn and weary face, a grin for Utanim, then cleared his throat and composed himself into rigid formality. I am Corwin Ravenhair of the Æsir, he announced, son of the Midgard Knight, and of She Who Builds Tomorrow, Watcher o'er the World Engine, Cavalier of Three Worlds, Chooser of the Slain. I am the Rune Knight of Iron, I am the Pillar of the Tenth World. All that Sephiro is, I am. Anise, Akio murmured, stunned. But you know. Corwin's formal smile became a rather less formal grin. Yep, he replied. You lose, buddy. Akio's eyes narrowed. Not if I kill you. You can't kill me. You're at least part Sephirian. I'm the pillar. If you could kill me, you'd have killed Emerald yourself instead of using the Rune Knights as your patsies. You're not off this world. The normal rules don't apply. Corwin chuckled. Wake up, Otori. You've got four Rune Knights and a great dragon against you, even if you do take me out. Face it. You've lost. It's over. Not yet, Akio insisted calmly. The tournament isn't over. Face me. Honor demands it. Honor? You make a claim of honor? What a fucking joke. Corwin snarled. Akio gave him an impassive smile. Nevertheless, I claim it, and you are bound to respond. Corwin sighed. If you insist on playing this game out, even though the ending is obvious to anyone who can see, then I guess I can't stop you. His bravado covered a very real fear. Farakio was right. The contest was not yet complete, and his apotheosis thus not yet secure. What was worse, he couldn't secure it himself, for as the newly invested pillar, he could not confront the challenge directly. But he could do the next best thing. Slowly, in a fashion that was almost stately, the group of them descended to the dueling platform. As they reached it, the upper platform vanished like a mirage, leaving the dueling floor bathed alone in the light of the world tree's roots. Corwin turned to Utina. "Utina Tenjo, Rune Knight of the Rose, Prince of the 10th World," he said formally, "you are called to defend your pillar." Utina leaned closer to him and whispered urgently, "Are you nuts? Letting him turn this into a matter of form? You've got a gun, just shoot him or something." She gave him a wry little grin and added, "My life would be complete without a rematch." "I've tried that," Corwin replied out of the side of his mouth. "Anyway, this is the way high magic works. He's right, the tournament isn't over. And until you're fully confirmed as my prince, I think as my high priest he might just be able to do what he says. The Rune Knights are exhausted, and the duelist's code might prevent them from acting anyway, I don't know. And I can't beat him, Utina. I've already tried. He's too good for me." Corwin had done many things over the course of his association with Utina that had raised her opinion of him. Here was another. How many young men in his position would admit that they had a fight on their hands they could not win? But then, he'd committed himself to total honesty with her, hadn't he? And she with him. She smiled, patted his shoulder, and said, "Okay." Then she reached to her side, found nothing there but an empty scabbard, and turned to him with a chagrined look. "I've lost the thorn," said Utina. Corwin just smiled at this. He took her rose seal from his left ring finger, raised her hand, kissed it, and then gently slid the magic ring down over her own finger. Utina felt the change, the uniform she'd arrived wearing dissolving like sugar in water as a blaze of light surrounded her. On her right ring finger, the duplicate rose seal which Corwin's Aunt Beldandy had invested with the power to contain Utrina's own mystic abilities shivered, then shattered with a high, bright sound. As it happened, she found herself speaking ancient words she hadn't known she knew. "I am love. I am perfect contentment. I am a jealous rage. I am sweetly scented beauty. I am thorns and toughness. I am all these things and more." When the light had gone, she remained, clad not in the uniform she'd arrived in, but a suit of gleaming black, scarlet-trimmed plate armor, with the sigil of the rose on the left side of the breastplate, and a scarlet-lined black cloak. In a small slot cut into the armor just above the rose crest, the real white rose she'd arrived wearing remained. "I am the Rune Knight of the Rose," Utina intoned. Then she seemed to snap out of it, looked down at herself, and gasped in surprise. "Wow," she said. Corwin gestured beckoningly to Anthy. She looked at him for a moment, puzzled. And then comprehension dawned on her face, and she smiled. Standing before Utina, she raised her hands level with the armored girl's face, touched her cheeks, traced the line of her down to the swell of her breastplate, and concentrated.
"But it's broken," Utina whispered.
"Trust us," said Anthy, and Utina smiled and closed her eyes. A bubble of light appeared in the space between Anthy's hands and Utrina's breastplate.
"Rose of the noble castle," Anthy murmured. "Heart of the rose that sleeps within this soul, heed your master and come forth."
With a chiming sort of sound, the haft of a sword emerged from the metal as though rising out of water. Utrina swooned, making a soft moan of pain, as the weapon emerged from her heart. Corwin took a step forward and caught her shoulders in one strong arm. Anthy took hold of the sword's grip and drew it forth. In a moment, the reason for Utrina's pain became obvious. The sword was broken, its blade ending only a few inches past the crossbeam in a jagged break. Light shone from Corwin's brand as Anthe held the broken sword, its broken end still pointed at Utina's heart. The energy gathered in brilliant rays at the dot in the center of the brand, and then sprang forth in a bright beam to encompass the sword. As it did so, Corwin began to incant. I am Corwin of the Raven Hair, Rune Knight of Iron, Pillar of the Tenth World. By my will and by my power, birthright from my divine mother, this is my command. Let this blade, this heart, once broken, be reforged. Let the heart of the rose be stronger for its trial. From the cracks and crevices in the pavement of the dueling floor and the Rose Gate catwalk, bright, glittering pieces of metal stirred themselves and rose. One by one they flew in great, sweeping arcs, entered the beam, and fitted themselves into place in the span of the blade, until at last the tip assumed its place, and the sword was whole again. Smiling, Corwin reached out and pressed the tip of his left index finger against the point of the blade. His skin dimpled, gave way, and a drop of blood welled out. At its touch, white brilliance rushed the length of the blade, following the fracture lines like water racing through grooves in stone, then rayed out from the hilt to bathe the three of them in light. When it faded, the metal of the blade had become whole again, bright and shining silver, save for a delicate tracery of deep black streaks where the fractures had been. What I have rejoined, said Corwin as he removed his fingertip from the sword's point. Let no man put asunder. He smiled at Utina as he eased her back up onto her feet. She grinned back at him, squared her shoulders, and took the heart of the rose from Anthe's hand. Grant me the power, she commanded the blade, to bring the world revolution. The heart of the rose gleamed expectantly. Cold scarlet fire flickered up and down the Damascus blade, played along her arm, as she stepped away from her friends and took up her place for the duel. Ever observant of the formalities, for this was a rose duel after all, Anthe went to the thing that called itself her brother, and formally fitted a blood-red rose into the top pocket of his jacket. You can't win, she murmured softly to him as she performed her duty. Admit defeat, and save yourself. You'll pay for defying me, he growled. I've been paying all my life, she said, looking him in the eye. Then, goodbye, Akio. She stepped back, taking up her position as witness, and nodded to the combatants in turn. Utina raised the heart of the rose to kiss the crossbeam in a crusader's salute, then swept it into a ready position and confronted her foe. For 120 silent seconds, the two enemies regarded each other with an intensity that nearly rippled the space between them, each motionless. The tension built until it seemed the very air must scream. Hikaru Shido gnawed at her knuckles. Umi Ryuzaki stood rooted to the spot, her face as colorless as bone. Nall bolt upright on her shoulder like a little statue. Fuho Hoji stood with her hands folded and eyes closed, lips moving in silent prayer. Corwin and Anthe stood calm and impassive, only their eyes betraying the awful strain they too were under. Utina knew she had reason for concern. Akio was a deadly opponent, perhaps the deadliest, most capable she would ever face. He hated her with a passion that rivaled any in the passionate land of Sephiro. And under the present conditions, he had nothing whatsoever to lose. Utina, on the other hand, had everything to lose. If she lost this duel, she would waste Corwin's incredible sacrifice, and everything would be for nothing. There would be no makeup date, no counter-challenge to be given. She would be flung back to Midgard alone, if not killed outright. And Anthe would be trapped here for all time, praying for a Sephiroth that her brother would rule, always and forever at his mercy. Her eyes, locked on Akio's this whole time, narrowed. No. Never. Never. Never! Gritting her teeth, screaming in wordless hatred and defiance, she threw herself forward. Shouting his challenge, Akio did the same.